Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, continuing our conversations about the cultures of consciousness. Had a nice long intro there, thanks to Mark Pilkington's awesome soundtrack. Well, today's a special edition of Expanding Mind. I first met our guest today, Alexander Bard, over 20 years ago. I was a young punk freelance writer, a rock critic, and I managed to, those were the glory days of freelance writing, and so you could get things like a free ticket to Sweden, plus a dollar a word to go and write about a completely bizarre and hilarious and marvelous act, such as the Army of Lovers, which was the band that Alexander had with two other total characters. And they had a bunch of hits in the early 90s, and they were super, super camp. And it was, in a way, like the sort of the kind of ideal expression of an old school camp aesthetic replayed and re-articulated for a new emerging electronic dance music, mad early 90s extravaganza culture. And we had a wonderful time driving, I believe, from Stockholm to Lund, where they were playing, and we had a great conversation and talked about Chernobyl and psychedelics and philosophy. And it's indeed in the realm of philosophy of all zones to emerge from a band such as the amazing Army of Lovers that Alexander has put his a great deal of his time and attention, though it's not the only thing that he's done. We will be talking largely about religion and philosophy today, but it is important to mention that in addition to being a member of the Pirate Party in Sweden, as well as a outspoken and sometimes controversial proponent of psychedelics and the rights of sexual minorities and sexual goofiness in most contexts, that Alexander is also a judge on Swedish Idol, which, as you might imagine, is the Swedish version of American Idol. And I'm not sure, I've never watched the show, but I think he's kind of the sort of sardonic one. But we'll have to check on that one. But that is not what brings us brings Alexander on the show today. Today we're going to be talking about Syntheism. Not just a book, although it is also a book, but a concept. The subtitle tells you some of what it's about, creating God in the Internet Age. It's a book that Alexander wrote with media theorist Jan Soderqvist, and together they have also written three other books called the Futurica Trilogy, which are really looking at how the internet has changed society, changed philosophy, changed subjectivity, and really trying to come up with ideas, concepts, and practices that can sort of engage, map, reframe our activity as individuals, as seekers, as political actors in this new arena. And in Syntheism, they take a really kind of remarkable step towards essentially the creation of a new religion or a new religious idea. And so we'll be diving into that, and it's going to be a fun conversation, I can guarantee you, because Alexander is quite a character. But before we bring Alexander to the show, we have another total character, Majidau. Majidau, and our White Witch of Los Angeles. So, how are you doing, Maja?
Hi, Eric. Yeah, well, it's pretty funny. We're all pretty cartoony. But that's the best way to be. No, I was excited to talk with Alexander for a number of reasons, and we got it prolonged. There was the coitus interruptus, so to speak. So I'm really looking forward to it. But like you're saying, with that, seeing the internet as a source of creation and experience with divinity, that happens to me all the time in extremely freaky deaky ways, where sometimes I just feel completely like Dr. Xavier on the X-Men, where I just like put some helmet on that connects me to everybody else when I go use the internet or Facebook, and I'll have the freakiest synchronicity experiences, which are shared by other people, so I know they're not delusional. So this is one of my favorite topics to kind of get into, because I've experienced it directly, as I know you have as well.
Absolutely. Well, with those kinds of synchronicities in mind, hopefully our the sprites that guide the world of Skype will be kind to us this week. We've had a couple of dropouts recently, but I think today we're going to have the spirits with us to talk to Mr. Alexander Bark. Alexander, welcome to Expanding Mind.
Hello there.
Excellent.
Okay.
You're coming in nice and crisp. That's what I wanted to hear.
Okay, great. Are we doing this without pictures, just sound?
Just sound. It makes it better that way. Makes the sprites happier.
Oh, yeah. So it's a podcast, actually. So, can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can hear you good. And, you know, it's also just to remind you, this is we stream live. So essentially it's like live radio. So we're
all
not
right.
Going back to it doesn't mean you can't say whatever you want. I'm just letting you know that in some sense this is a live show. So, hey, it's really great to talk to you again. I was saying in the introduction, you know, it's been 20 years since we spoke, except, a month ago when we were trying to set up the show. And I've really been enjoying watching your evolving career. What a remarkable mixture of public philosopher, record impresario, Swedish idol judge, psychedelic raconteur. It's really quite a wonderful and wild ride. Have you been enjoying the response to Cynthiaism?
Yeah, I just lost you there for a few seconds, but I'm back.
Good. You might want to take your visual off because it'll increase the strength of the signal.
Exactly. Good idea.
There we go. Beautiful.
Yeah.
So, yes, how are you enjoying the response to Cynthiaism? Are you flying all over? Are you the philosopher a la mode?
Well, it's kind of funny because the idea for the book was actually born at Burning Man 4 years ago. And I started to look around and realize that this was something that was going to happen anyway because it was popping up in so many different places. And from different different angles to this, one of them is, of course, that when you go to participatory festivals like Burning Man, and 4 years ago there were about 30 different spin-offs around the world, now there are over 100. So the whole Burning Man movement, what I would call the participatory cultural movement, is actually the fastest growing social cultural phenomenon on the planet right now. And I would even go so far as to say that this is the first example of an internet-based social movement in physical space. So it's the first time we see a major social artistic movement that starts online and then moves to the physical space rather than the other way around, the way we're used to. So that's one aspect of it, and I think that's the aspect that's most obvious to Americans. The other aspect of it is actually sort of from a perspective of history of ideas. I currently live in Scandinavia, which is probably the most atheistic culture humanity has ever known. You wouldn't believe this as an American, but I actually live in a country where 95% of people admit to being atheists, and nobody ever goes to church. And if they would go to church here, they would laugh their heads off. We can't take American creationism any more seriously than we take Islamic fundamentalism in Iraq or something like that. So it's a culture that's completely atheistic. But the funny thing is, if you lived in an atheistic culture for about 100 years, you will start thinking, maybe we threw the baby out with the bathwater. Maybe there's something to religion or spirituality we've actually lost. And that's exactly what the Cynthiaist movement is taking off first in countries like Scandinavia and Germany and Holland and Northern Europe, because these are very atheistic cultures.
So that's another aspect in
these two things. The participatory culture actually is a spiritual exercise. I mean, if you're at Burning Man on Saturday night, that would be an absolutely obvious thing. Burning Man is the Hajj to Mecca for Silicon Valley entrepreneurs. So that's a religious phenomenon. And if you describe it from sort of a post-atheistic, technology-friendly perspective, like we're searching for a new credible form of spirituality that isn't New Age, then it all starts to make sense.
Yes, that makes a lot of sense. I think that was helped me understand what you were doing in your book is really coming from atheism, and then it really made a lot more sense to me how you were putting together these pieces. It was kind of like religion after the atheist sort of recognition that there's no higher supernatural principle that exists in some kind of ongoing way, that we're part of an indifferent cosmos that's creative, contingent, ever moving forward, and that in some sense we are responsible for creating our values and for engaging with the novelty that history and technology keep throwing into our faces. From my perspective, it's an interesting one. I mean, and I'm glad the way you located it, partly in a Scandinavian context, in the sense of being that part of Europe, and particularly Northern Europe, that is just profoundly atheistic in ways that, you know, even as someone who's familiar with those kinds of discourses, it's sometimes a little shocking to me when I visit those places, like, wow, it's just not here. You know, and I come from the West Coast, where there's much more of a weird mix of older religious ideas, New Age ideas, hippie ideas that are sort of melanges of some atheistic notions and then some supernatural ideas, some theistic ideas. And these things are all bound up in various weird ways with technology. So in some ways, I think that you're in a place where you can see the potential of technology and the internet in a different way than I can, because I'm so immersed in this sort of originary California context where all these things are blurred together. But starting with let's just go with the participatory festival, since it's a good connection. It's a
okay,
good.
Can I just add one thing to what you just said? Because that is very interesting. Because we obviously know a lot of what was going on in California. Americans tend to forget that they're at the top of what I call the information pyramid of the world. That means that America, in a way, is a boring place to visit for non-Americans, because we already know everything that goes on there. We can't avoid it. American culture is just everywhere all the time. But the problem with America is that Americans are not as aware of the world outside of America as they should be, with you and a few other people are as exceptions. But the interesting thing here is that it's exactly, although California is ahead here in the terms of your term technosis is excellent here. I mean, you were prophetic when you launched that term, because you observed a phenomenon early on. What we're trying to do in the Synthesis book is that we're trying to give it a grand theory to make sense of it. But the problem is, when you export American New Age spirituality to Europe, people hate it over here. They hate its guts. They just think it's just rubbish. It was called paganism here, and we left it behind 1,500 years ago. We don't consider it civilized. And it's also the fact that a lot of the neo-paganism or New Age is like a supermarket form of religion. You're supposed to go into the supermarket and shop little Buddhas there and little Thors there and little whatever, and put together your own individualistic religion, which is kind of a fake way of doing religion, because religion should be taken seriously. So actually, one of the things I would say Synthism stands for is it's not aggressive against New Age in the sense that we cannot collaborate or do artistic things together, and I'm sure New Agers and Synthists get along really well at Burning Man, but Synthism definitely is something very different from New Age. And that's exactly where Californian spirituality is at right now. It needs to decide, or it has to be split up into two different sections. One I would call Synthism, the other one I would call New Age. New Age is fine with me. I can respect it, but I'm not a New Ager, and I do not want to go to some kind of a church on Sundays to celebrate with New Agers when they come into through the door with all their hocus pocus, you know. And that is why I think there's a need for Synthism. Synthism is closer related to Zen Buddhism or the Dzogchen Buddhism in Tibet, or it's related to Zoroastrianism or related to you know, Anavaita Vedanta in India, monist philosophies, but it's not related to New Age. And I think in California, it's hard to make this distinction still. And I think
it's just that those things are all mixed up. I mean, those elements are
all mixed up in California, but not in Europe. And an interesting aspect of this is that in America, spirituality is a positive word and religion is negatively loaded. In Europe, it's the other way around, precisely because religion is now so freaky that it's becoming interesting, whereas spirituality is completely associated with hippie ladies with crystals, which people hate over here and are tired of. They want something different, something more profound, something that ties in with the internet, with the new physics, and with the contingent universe. And that's what we write about in the Synthism book.
Yes. No, so it was really helpful for me. Of all the kind of similarities you just mentioned, I think people are going to be, you know, listening are going to be familiar with Zen. They're going to be familiar with Vedanta ideas through Hinduism and yoga. But the one really interesting element on your list, and I know it's an important part of your own spiritual and religious life and has been for a long time, and is an important part of Sintheism that we don't hear very much about, is Zoroaster and Zoroastrianism. And I'd love to just hear a little bit, maybe even speaking personally, about what was it about that faith that drew you so many years ago, and also what it has to say about Sintheism and about creating religion in our current environment.
Well, I grew up with an uncle who was a professor of theology, probably one of the last two ones in Scandinavia. And he called himself the last Christian, by the way. He was sort of already post-Christian back then. You know, the majority of Lutheran priests in Sweden did not believe in God. So there you go. But it was in the 1980s, and he challenged me, and he said, well, if you don't want Christianity, why don't you go out there and learn from the worlds of philosophy and religion and find your own way of life? And I studied it, and through Nietzsche, I came in contact with Zoroastrianism. And this was in the 1980s when huge numbers of Zoroastrians were leaving Iran, and scholars were coming from Iran to Europe and America. And you know, they arrived in America in the 1980s, and the Zoroastrian community in America now, on average, have a higher education and higher incomes than even the Jews. It's the most successful ethnic minority in American history. It's really interesting. Why would a religion or a philosophy which is 3,700 years old be so adaptable to contemporary society? Because it's pro-ecology, it's pro-gender equality, all kinds of good things that they're in there. And I started going back to the roots in the 1980s. Are you there?
Yes.
Okay, good. Some disturbance here. Anyway, I started going back to the roots and discovered that in the 1980s that I learned ancient Persian and, you know, got into Iranian philosophy the way I'd gone into Indian and Chinese philosophy before that. And I discovered Zoroastrianism is the most misunderstood phenomenon ever. I mean, if you go into any encyclopedia, I bet even Wikipedia, they would talk about some kind of a cosmological dualism and two different gods and good and evil fighting out. That is George Bush in Iraq. That has nothing to do with Zoroastrianism whatsoever. And I went back to the roots to Zoroaster's own teachings. He wrote a script called the Gathas, meaning the songs, which is probably the most ancient monotheistic manifesto ever, written 3,700 years ago. But his monotheism was completely different from the Abrahamic faiths. He was a pantheist, and he regarded the world as being sacred. But it was a pantheism with a twist, because he used two different terms. One was aura, which is being in the Heideggerian sense. And the other term was mazda, meaning sense or mind. And his point was that the divine is really where being meets mind, and it's through mind that being comes to be conscious of itself. Now, that is the divine mind, if anything. And the point being here is that we as human beings are actually responsible for being divine creatures ourselves. So everything ends up with us and the responsibility with us to be social creatures and to create a civilization and a society which is harmonious and good for everybody. And that is his religion. Now, that is the most radical political ideology ever. You know, he made it very simple, straightforward. This is what we're here to do. We're on this planet to, during our lives and before we die, try to create something meaningful for ourselves out of this world. And meaning is not external. It will not be supplied to us. And the funny thing is that Zoroastrianism is a religion without any commandments, without any morality whatsoever, and still has the lowest rate of crime you'd find in any religion. It has strong members. It believes in empowerment of its believers. It's an amazing faith, and it's non-missionary, which is exactly why there are only 3 million Zoroastrians in the world rather than 2 billion or something like that. So they were opening up to conversions, and in 1992, I had my conversion ceremony performed. One of my friends at that ceremony was Trita Parsi, who's now the head of the American-Iranian Council. So he's Barack Obama's advisor in Washington for Iranian affairs, and he's very involved in trying to, you know, achieve the peace deal right now with Iran. So I got really fascinated with all this and converted, and I was part in starting up the first Zoroastrian community in Sweden. We now have a few thousand members, and I am still a Zoroastrian. Sintheism is just Zoroaster's ideas, 3,700 years old, removed from the Iranian nationalist context. It's like taking an idea from India or China or Iran, for that matter, and just relieving it from its nationalist connotations. You don't have to cook Iranian food to practice Sufism. And then the idea is just cleansed from that. But when I look at process philosophy or monist philosophy, which is what Sufism has to be if it's going to be compatible with contemporary physics, then I would definitely go as far back as Zoroaster 3,700 years ago, because there's nothing in Zoroaster's teachings that modern physicists could not subscribe to.
And I want to say right here, just for people listening, that you know, we're starting to talk about, you know, philosophy, philosophical ideas, and your books are philosophical, but they're also very accessible. And if people are just willing to do a little bit of legwork, you know, there's not elaborate footnotes. It's not academic philosophy, and that's a real important distinction that you make and that you talk about. That in a way, philosophy has gone in a terrible route in the 20th century by sort of entering into academia and in these sort of little cybernetic feedback loops inside these institutions, and it no longer is sort of engaged with the outside, with people's concerns outside, or with the language or issues outside. And so for you, when you talk about... when you talk about process philosophy, or when you talk about monism, these are really crucial ideas that are motivating how we actually see the world. And let's just go with process. Let's go with the idea of what it means.
Let's just add to that, is that...
Sure.
We have three major revolutions in the 20th century. One is the internet. We're all now interconnected with each other at all times, and our little gadgets are connected with that as well. I mean, this is just the beginning of a whole new age. The other thing is the new physics. My God, I mean, we discovered we were in a galaxy called the Milky Way less than 100 years ago. Now we know we're in a world of billions and billions of galaxies, and there are billions and billions of universes out there. I mean, the world is so incredibly massive. It's so huge. And if that isn't God, if the universe is not God, then I don't know what God would be, you know? And philosophy hasn't dealt with these things. It took a philosopher like Karen Barad, who's at Stanford in America, and she's a professor of both philosophy and physics, to finally make philosophers understand the implications of the revolution in physics. And what I try to do is to add to that the revolution in the digital, in how we communicate with each other, and how the world has to change because of that. I mean, Immanuel Kant's paradigm is overdone with. Basically, what philosophers have done for 300 years is no longer valid. And I love this. And while I'm doing it, in my four books with Jan Söderqvist, we always try to be as accessible as we can. I want to reach out to as many people as I possibly can. But if you sometimes get stuck with something in our books, and we've tried really hard to communicate it, then just read more. Go back to the words. It's probably just a term that you didn't get. You can always go to Wikipedia and find out for yourself, because I'm dying to be as accessible as I possibly can without losing quality to what we're writing about, because we really are philosophers. You're right about that.
Let's go with the physics. I mean, one thing that, you know, one of the markers, let's say, of New Age as a counter distinction is that it is also interested in physics, but without getting into the problems of the New Age appropriation of physics, what you draw and what a philosopher like Karen Barad draws from physics is something different, an equally spiritual message, but a very different one. So why don't you give us that?
When New Age talks about quantum physics, they talk about quantum therapy and all kinds of silly things. You know, as soon as they are New Age, they just take words that are new words from physics and drop them around like if they were some kind of a profound insight, when they have no idea what they're talking about. That is Karen Barad's point too. That's my point too. I am genuinely interested in real physics. I went to the damn Stockholm School of Economics in the 1980s. My best friend was called Max Tegmark. He's now a physicist at Harvard. You probably heard about him. And I completely disagree with him on physics, by the way, you know, because he's the last Platonist. But he's a great physicist. And I'm interested in the dialogue that's going on inside the world of physics and what it has to teach us. And I love cosmology. And there are great ways of finding out how it actually works, you know. And synthists in general are incredibly interested in physics and what it can teach us. You know, the stuff we don't have to believe in, the stuff we already know, we should know more about and be curious about first. Faith is only what we use when we don't have the proper knowledge. So I would say New Age are not really interested in physics. They're interested in using the terminology for their own gains. Synthists are genuinely interested in physics. That's the difference.
So what is the synthesis, what's the reading of physics? What are the important messages that we get from contemporary physics
really
that we have to incorporate?
Yes, exactly. Philosophically and spiritually speaking, the really important basic lesson that contemporary physics teaches us is that there are no objects out there. They're not primary. There are no things out there. Our brains create the things out of the fields that exist there. You know, we always heard about that, you know, physics are either fields or particles. And depending on where the observer is positioned, it will either be a particle or it will be a field. Now, that's not actually correct. Because before the observer enters the room, there's nothing but the field there. So it is in our perception, and in our perception, when our perception collaborates, gets entangled with the physical world around us, that's exactly when the particle starts to occur. So any kind of object, even the smallest possible object you could think of, which is the point, you know, a point, you know, a point does not exist per se. There are only fields, and these fields are so absurd. They don't consist of things. They're just fields, power fields. And that is the basic premise of physics. And that means, in a fundamental sense, when we talk about relationships, and we all know we live in a world of relationships. We have relationships between us. We're 7 billion people who are entangled with each other in different ways. And we're entangled with our surroundings, with our dogs and our cats and our TVs and our computers and the moon and the stars and everything else. You know, everything is entangled with everything else. And we know this is called gravity in physics, the fact that everything in the universe affects everything else more or less. So everything is entangled with everything else. But this is the thing. The relations are primary. What exists first is the relation. And only after the relation exists does a relator, an object, pop out. So the node does not exist before the network. The network exists before the node. And this we have to take all the way to our own understanding of who we are, to our own existentialism, to our own philosophy of who we are and what the world is that we live in. We have to redo Kant and Heidegger and all these guys and basically throw them out and redo the whole fundamental exercise of philosophy to understand what the world is like. And in this book, the Synthesism book, we actually trace this back to a really weird British-American philosopher named Alfred North Whitehead. He wrote a really weird book called Process and Reality in 1929. And in parallel with Whitehead, he was primarily a mathematician. He wrote excellent mathematics first, then he became a philosopher. But in parallel with Whitehead, Niels Bohr and the other guys who were doing quantum physics in the 1920s were working on the idea that maybe quantum physics was trying to teach us human beings something about the nature of the world. And a few years after Whitehead's weird book came out, that was in 1929, in 1935, there was a correspondence between Bohr and Albert Einstein, the two leading physicists at the time in the world. And Bohr desperately realized in the middle of the conversation that Einstein didn't get quantum physics. Einstein still lived in a world where objects were primary. And in that case, time must be an illusion. That means that time does not exist. And that was Plato's idea of the world. And Bohr basically told Einstein, you're absolutely wrong. What quantum physics is teaching us is that time is fundamental. Time is the big mystery of physics, and time or duration just moves in one direction. It doesn't actually move in different directions. It moves in one direction. That means that there's only one world, monism. There are no different worlds. There are no dualisms. You know, Plato was wrong. Christianity was wrong. The soul and the body are never separate. The soul is just an aspect of the body. It's just one world, and it's monist, and it's indeterministic. That means the future is open. Basically, anything can happen at any given time. It's just a question of probability. So this is the world we actually live in. And what Karen Barad and I and other philosophers also do physics these days, try to teach people, is the implications of physics for philosophy. And that is that we live in an indeterministic world and we live in a modest universe. And this is a universe consisting of relations that are pure relations. And relata only occur from these relations. I mean, our parents exist before we exist. We are the nodes in the networks that our parents build for us.
Yeah, one of the interesting things there is how this network idea coming from physics, or this idea that the relations exist before any objects do, it resonates with the sort of new technological form that
yes.
we have. And, yes. And so that's where these sort of connections come to be, because in addition to your interest in philosophy, you also do something that I've always felt is absolutely necessary for any real engagement with history, is to understand history in many ways, I don't want to say primarily, but with the transformation of technology, in particular media technology, as being in some ways the driver, or at least as important a driver as anything else, so that when you have things like writing, when you have the printing press, when you have even the telegraph, and then certainly when you have something like the internet, you have to have a new conversation.
Every time these technologies have a breakthrough. And this is the thing. If we're seriously going to discuss history and sort of divide history into different epochs that really have made a difference, and say we're going to do it empirically and be a bit scientific about it, what would be the ultimate way of measuring different epochs? It would be the amount of information we have available to us to play around with. And then we can observe that the amount of information we have available to us has jumped four times in history. The first jump was when we started talking. That's when human beings separated from animals and became something distinctly separate from animals. We talk, animals do not. So we can have a conversation between us and exchange information on a far higher scale than animals ever could. The second thing is we started to write. That was 5,000 years ago. Another huge jump in the amount of information available to us. We could create permanent settlements. We could domesticate plants, domesticate animals, and create civilizations. That started 5,000 years ago. You cannot create a civilization without the capacity to write first. The third big jump was the printing press, and that is the society our parents have lived in, and that's the society we lived in for the past 400 years. The printing press was the condition for capitalism, industrialism, nationalism, colonialism. You know, all the isms we've had over the last 400 years are the results of the printing press, because we created books, newspapers, and paper money out of the printing press. And all those three aspects of the printing press have revolutionized the world. And again, made information available to us on a far more complex scale than before. The fourth such jump in history is the internet. You now, with your smartphone in your pocket, have more information available to you and better organized than the entire world had 5 years ago in your own pocket. That means we have enormous capacity today for innovation and recreating the world in a whole new way. And this is the interesting thing. With each one of these four jumps, we've had to recreate metaphysics. When we started talking, we created the tribal metaphysics, concentrating on the Urfather and the Urmadr and the rain dancing and paganism. Now, following that, when we installed the permanent settlements and started writing, the first thing we would do to write holy scriptures, and we created monotheism, and we had saints or gods that were sort of secondary to the one God. And we could then create an agrarian society built on that. And the funny thing is, the Enlightenment philosophers in France in the 17th century did the same revolution all over again for the printing press world. The Enlightenment world, with science at the forefront and with the individual replacing God as the center of the universe, the individual human being and the undeniable rights of the individual, you know, all those things we lived in for the past 40 years, were the metaphysics that worked. More so here in Scandinavia, probably, than anywhere else in the world. Now, individualism is dying today. It doesn't work any longer. It doesn't pay off to be an individual online. In the online world, we're now creating a whole new kind of social sphere. We're collaborating with people. That is why it's called the internet. That's why we talk of interactivity. That's why we talk of collaboration. That's why we talk of participatory culture. These are all synonyms for a new world where collaboration pays off. And it's the people who can collaborate the most, and it's the people who are socially intelligent who are the new winners. Now, they will need a new metaphysics. So we need to redo the Enlightenment all over again. And the response to that is synthesis.
Excellent. You know, I'm going to cut you off right here, Alexander. We need to take a break. You're listening to Expanding Mind. We're talking with Alexander Bard, and we'll be right back after this message.
Welcome back to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. This is Maja Daou here with Eric Davis, and we are speaking with Alexander Bard about Cynthiaism. First, I just wanted to add for listeners that were interested to separate New Age from some of the other occult material, which I like to do vehemently. You can find a lot of the ideas that you were talking about earlier, Alexander, in a lot of the, they call it panentheism instead of pantheism. Paracelsus and a lot of the early alchemists started promoting a lot of that material and that mindset you were talking about in terms of using the mind, which goes back into a lot of the Gnostic, Hermetic, alchemical material, which I always like to look at instead of some of the New Agey stuff, which was later developed, and some people think might have even been started by the CIA, if you want to get all conspiracy about it. But there is other good information, and a lot of that stuff is inundated in all the Taoist material and a lot of the Kung Fu material, too. But to get on with some of the exciting stuff that you're doing with the Syntheism, can you let folks know, like, what would be an example of what you guys actually, like, do, like, an action to help kind of promote some of this collaborative mentality or a consciousness that expands into working with other people in that way? Like, what kind of stuff do you guys do?
Okay, one of the things we do is that we look at festivals like Burning Man, because the strength of Burning Man, it's the easiest thing in the world to slash Burning Man. I mean, if Occupy would go there this year, they would go get a lot of attention because they would just go to Billionaire's Row and it would be all over the place. I mean, it can be, Burning Man can be considered like a really vulgar capitalist phenomenon. But I decide to look at the positive side of things, which is its utopian potential. And I find it interesting that no matter how cynical people are all these days, people actually do go to a place and try to play it. They're involved with the temporary utopia for 7 days, where they do not exchange money, where they give gifts to strangers without any back thoughts whatsoever of getting repaid, and they're training themselves to see other human beings in front of them rather than just instrumentalizing human relations, which is what capitalism fosters us to do. I find this incredibly interesting because I, among radical philosophers today, I agree with Simon Critchley when he says that this is not the time for the revolution. Because if you create a revolution today, it becomes like Occupy Wall Street. You got on the streets and you yell and shout for 3 weeks and you take your selfie and your little Facebook page and you get a T-shirt and you go back home and nothing changes. You cannot do the revolution right now. This is instead an age where subtraction is what we need to do. We need to pull back and look at the world from a distance. And that is why I'm interested in what New Age did in a positive way. I'm working, for example, with the Integral Center in Colorado with Robert McNaughton, the other guys there. The good part of New Age, the intellectual part of New Age, I don't mind that at all. I'm interested in Burning Man and participatory culture, and it's over 100 spin-offs around the world. And I'm on the board of several of these festivals in Europe, and I'm heavily involved in it personally because I think that's an excellent starting point. But next, after these temporary utopias, we have to start to create the permanent utopias. And I think many eco-villages in North America and Europe are trying to do exactly that. That is a place where I go to look for the beginning of the new, for what I think is true radicality in our age, is to try to create sustainable environments with alternative economies that isolate themselves from the outside world. Because if they create models that work, those models can then be copied by others. And that is always what really good religion did. It created new social models that then can be copied by others.
So it's not like Burning Man, provides like an area where those kind of things can be explored and experimented with to try to find some kind of more permanent solution.
Exactly. And the thing with Burning Man is that it's artistic. And the only thing that makes art different from religion is that art has a kind of ironic shield to it. It's easy to be artistically involved, and therefore I encourage the kids to go artistic first and express themselves artistically in participatory art. Okay, this is what Burning Man is. Experiment and create art together. We're just opening a huge new space here in Stockholm this summer where it's only going to be for people to create non-commercial collective art together. Art is a great introduction, but as soon as you remove the irony and you start to take art really seriously, it becomes religion. Religion is the word for the transition from art to existential seriousness. And I would like to add one thing. There's a huge guerrilla movement. We don't discuss it that way, but there's a huge guerrilla movement right now, both in Europe and North America, and it's called psychedelic drugs. And psychedelic drugs are illegal just about everywhere, and I think they have enormous revolutionary potential. We call it esoteric synthism over here. But I think what's happening with substances like ayahuasca, for example, right now in so many different countries, and the healing effects people are discovering, and how that movement is now exposing the old society we've lived in as a big lie. It's not only that we know the capitalism fooled us and thought that we would live happily ever after, and we never became happy with capitalism. We became only more frustrated and hated ourselves even more. And the same way, there were so many other ideological lies we lived in for the past 300 years. One of them was sobriety. There is no such thing as sobriety. There's no sober human beings. Our brains are full of chemicals and hormones at all times. So why not put nice chemicals and hormones in there that make us happy and creative? You know, and I think the revolutionary potential of psychedelic drugs is an important aspect of this whole thing.
No, absolutely. I mean, and that's, you know, one of the things that's been motivating us. One point you make about psychedelics in the book that I thought was really good is that there's two consequences to the decision to sort of explore psychedelics. One is the sort of it affirms immediately that in a major way, if not totally, we are chemical metabolic beings. It's a sort of you in the very practice of engaging with a psychoactive substance, you are affirming the fact that you are a body that is affected by molecules and things from the outside, and that you have a metabolic process, that you're part of that process world that you talked about, that we're ongoing physical things in this cosmos spilling forward in time. That's metabolic process, where you come up and you go down. There's an up and there's a down. And then the second thing you point out, and this is the one I'd like to maybe talk a little bit more about, is that there's a difference between the person who decides, who programs their experience, well, tonight, you know, I'm just going to sit back and smoke a joint and watch a movie, or actually tonight I'm going to do ayahuasca and face the overwhelming impersonal magical terror of the universe in its fullness, because I need that experience. So there's the person who decides, who engineers the experience to some degree, and then there's
absolutely
the person who undergoes it. And the person who undergoes it. And they're not the same thing. And that tells us something about psychology.
I borrow a term here from the French philosopher Gilles Deleuze. I mean, Gilles Deleuze is the European whitehead. He's the greatest thinker of the 20th century. I cannot overrate Deleuze's influence. Gilles Deleuze, Google him, read him, read him, read him. You know, it'll make you an intelligent human being to read Gilles Deleuze. And he's amazing. But Deleuze wanted to kill the individual and introduce a different concept, the individual. The divided, multiple human being, where we're several people in the same body. And that's exactly why the body becomes so important. The body is the only thing that's solitary here. And when we think of ourselves, we should think of ourselves as bodies, not as souls in bodies. You know, we can start hating the body and all that. Rather, the body is the harmonious whole we should look for. And inside that body, we can actually harbor a lot of different people. And a perfect example is it precisely when you take a chemical and your mind changes. Because there's one individual who takes the chemical, and there's another you that then experiences that. And that's exactly where you realize that you are different human beings in the same body.
Oh, that's beautiful. Now, the whole idea of the individual, and then how to work with that. I mean, how to not interpret that as meaning like, what, I'm just a cog in a machine. Oh, I'm just an effect of all of the circumstances around me. It's like how to create a sense of dynamics and of agency once we've moved beyond the individual. And that's something else you talk about. You distinguish between individuality, which is this old idea, there's a molar individual, it's set apart, it's bounded, and that's part of that older capitalist model, and et cetera. And now we're in this network world where we're individuals. But then how do you actually be a individual? How do you not just be a repetitive machine? How do you overcome? How do you grow? How do you become something new, something even more singular, more distinct? And you talk about that in terms of creating a kind of sense of agency, which is not the same thing as individualism.
Exactly. I borrow the term from Kahnbrand. I think it's wonderful because sometimes as a philosopher, you use new words just to get away from the old ideas. Because individualism started with the world's most famous tweet ever: I think, therefore I am. And we should note this was a quote by the French autistic philosopher René Descartes 400 years ago. And it's a good starting point because René was obviously totally wrong here. I think, therefore I am, to begin with, is tautological. It doesn't prove anything at all. The I, the experience of the I, is nothing but a byproduct of what the body does. when our perception receives all these huge amounts of information we get from the outside world every day, and our body is trying to make sense of it all, our brain tries to, you know, make sense of it all and put it into a whole, it will actually have to add quite a lot of imagination to make sense. And once it does that, the last thing the brain actually adds is the I experience, the experience that there's just something solid that unites it all, because the world has to be one. Otherwise, it becomes completely incomprehensible to us. Thomas Metzinger has written about this. John Sedekvist and I have written about it before in a book called The Body Machine. So contemporary neuroscience actually proves that the I is a byproduct. It's something that happens later in the brain. The brain is actually in full swing, creating all these wonderful things. And one of the things I've experienced during my psychedelic spiritual experiences, because my strongest spiritual experience have been on psychedelics, and one of the things I've experienced is actually how the brain falls in love with itself, and how the brain becomes the universe and it reflects the universe. And if there's one thing we as human beings really, really want more than anything, is to love ourselves. And I don't mean love ourselves in a narcissistic sense, because narcissism is just totally wrong. I mean, that's when we go going on wrong. That's like a pathological disorder. No, what I mean is genuine self-love, a love which is not afraid of dying, a love which is in harmony with the outside world and enjoys living inside a world and the sublime horror of the universe itself and embraces it. And that is where we want to get. Our spiritual journey is a journey towards the acceptance and the love of things as they are.
Yeah. No, I think this is very beautiful. No, it's funny.
There's a lot in common here, I think.
Yeah, I want to press you on this because I also thought this was a point that I starred on my, you know, long list of notes, is this distinction between narcissism and self-love. And that one of the things, you know, we haven't talked too much about the negative aspects of the new network society, though there are plenty and you talk about them. One that I notice is how the kind of social media that we have seems to, in many ways, intensify a kind of narcissism and an internarcissism, where people are sort of feeding each other's narcissism as a way to keep the whole thing going.
But that's precisely because we don't have the new metaphysics yet. And after having written three books with John Sedekvist and returning from Burning Man 4 years ago, John and I had a conversation on Skype. I was in San Francisco, he was in Stockholm, and he said, we actually have to write that metaphysics book ourselves. Even if it's only the opening to new metaphysics and other writers are going to follow us, we have to actually point out that we need a new metaphysics because we're using old models to understand new phenomena. A perfect example of that is the selfie, you know, and Instagram. And Instagram is exactly what MySpace was 12 years ago. And I wrote an infamous paper in 2003 declaring the death of MySpace. And people thought I was absolutely mad. Because they said, MySpace is 500 million followers. How can you say this is not the future? And I said, no, it isn't, because it's a fucking Ponzi scheme. You know, we have to make a difference between the things on the internet that will thrive and survive because they actually help us, and the things that only play into our narrow little childish egos and actually kill it for us. MySpace was a place where loads of people uploaded music that nobody ever listened to and then pretended to be each other's fans by adding each other. Whenever a social forum has the line, thank you for the ad in it, that means three people are involved in a lying procedure. One person is adding somebody they don't know and expecting something in return for lying to a third person. So, you know, it's just rubbish. And in a way, Instagram has become the same thing, because the vast majority of pictures people upload to Instagram, and I don't want to kill it for all those families with kids out there who love having pictures of the kids, but the truth is that 99% of the pictures on Instagram are never, ever watched. They're just uploaded. It's become like this, you know, intestine of the world, where people are just throwing out media production all the time that nobody cares about.
I love the intestine of the world.
This means absolutely nothing. It means nothing to nobody. I should stop.
But how do we switch from narcissism
to be social?
I want to ask you, how do we switch from narcissism to self-love? How do we not, rather than go, oh, narcissism is bad, everyone's too obsessed with their ego, we need to have a higher ideal.
There is another kind of love there. I'm not moralizing against narcissism. I tell you what, I've worked as a psychoanalyst for many years, and narcissism is, I feel sorry for people who suffer from it. It's not something I'm moralizing against. You know, the thing is this, a narcissist is a person who didn't get enough attention from his parents when he was a kid. So he runs around all the time showing everything he's done to everybody, to get some kind of a gratification. Like, oh, look what I just did. I shot this picture. Oh, look what I just did. I made this music. Oh, look what I just did. I made this media here and this there. And, you know, they start blogs and they just throw things at people all the time. We know them all. We have them online every day. We have these people who self-promote constantly. They're just puking out stuff, waiting for some kind of recognition. That is narcissism. Narcissism is a kind of human activity that is not interested in feedback. It's not interested in any other kind of feedback than, oh, I love you and you're so good. You're a little good kid, you know. Self-love is the complete opposite. It's a very mature, grown-up thing. It's the realization that you've been thrown into this world, as Heidegger said. You know, you never meant to, but suddenly you realize you're in this world and you have this I experience, you know, inside a body. And it's this beautiful thing. And you can experience the most beautiful things in life, like art and love and psychedelic drugs and spiritual experiences. And you can be involved with other people. You can be involved in love with other people. And I don't mean just physical love, but I mean spiritual, psychological love, friendship love, all kinds of wonderful relationships with other people. We can have fun together and love each other. And this embracing of the world and embracing of your fellow human beings, that is the starting point for that is self-love. Because you cannot love other people unless you love yourself first. And a person who loves themselves will not be narcissistic. They will not need the constant recognition of others. Their behavior will be supportive towards others. The self-loving person has one thing in their mind, and that is that, how can I help others to expand and become what they should be? And that is the obsession of the self-loving person, which is the exact opposite of the narcissist.
Yeah, and to help produce that experience, that's partly where spiritual experiences come along. I mean, it's
exactly. My job in synthism on a personal level is to take people from narcissism to self-love. And that chapter, I think, of the synthism book, at the end of the day, is the most profound chapter of the whole book. Because for some strange reason, people constantly mistake this. They mistake narcissism and self-love when they're actually opposites. And I think one of the problems is people don't understand how you reach self-love. They think it's a feeling you're supposed to wait for. No, it isn't. It's a decision. It's an act of faith, the ultimate act of faith. You decide that you love yourself. Just stand naked in front of a mirror and accept whatever you see there and start loving it.
Well, I want to emphasize this point you just made. We only have a couple minutes left, but it's something that it's been really key in my own life, and it's something that's in your book, and it's something that's one of my favorite things about philosophy, is that distinction you just made. I think a lot of people feel that the things that they sense they need, like genuine self-love or an ability to be reconciled with death or whatever the issue is, and they feel like it should be a feeling, that there should be an emotion there, some yes. kind of sense of this and that. And yes, those things can be very illuminating and wonderful, and sometimes they come unbidden, but they're equally important, if not more important, is this notion of decision. And it's hard to articulate because it's not just like, oh, okay, I think I'll do that. It's something really profound. It's existential, but it's also cognitive. It is an yeah. act of faith, but it has a sort of your agency is a part of it. It's not just like, I'm little, I need God, so I'm going to believe in God. No, it's your stepping up to your faith and affirming it. And when you do that as an existential act, yeah. it makes things happen and the world shifts.
Oh, yeah, and you realize God is in you. Whatever God is, it's in you.
I'm afraid, Alexander, we're going to have to stop there. But it's a good way to end.
Oh, I love talking to you guys.
I know this is totally fun.
I grow in this process. That's why I love these conversations.
I know, me too. It's great. And I hope that others out there feel little spurts of growth within. So once again, it's check out Syntheism, Alexander Bard, and Jan Soderquist. It's a chewy, wonderful read. And we'll have you back, Alexander. Thanks so much for joining us on Expanding Mind.
I understand the synthesis listening to this conversation. Go and read Eric Davies' fucking books. They're brilliant and prophetic.
Wonderful. Okay, well.
It's great.
Okay. From me and Majid Ali out there, keep your minds open.
Okay.